T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Welcome to Insider Talk. I'm your host, Rodney Boyd. And today we're talking about what everybody in the world is talking about, the nouveau coronavirus and its impacts. And normally I talk to elected officials or people who work in around government, but today I have a very special guest, Dr. Laura Punch. Dr. Punch is new to this show but not new to the community, and I'll let you, Dr. Punch, introduce yourself so that we get your credentials right, we inform people of who you are. So first of all, welcome to the show. Welcome to Insider Talk. Delighted to have you. Sorry that it has to be under such abnormal in extraordinary circumstances, but for the listeners who know you, would you please introduce yourself to our listening audience?
Yes, I'm Dr. Punch, and I fill many roles here in St. Louis, but today, just for the record, I'm speaking for myself and my role as president of Power for STL, which is a nonprofit organization that's working to reduce the impact of violence in the St. Louis region. I am a trauma surgeon at Barnes Jewish Hospital, and I'm an associate professor at Washington University School of Medicine.
And, you know, with all those different hats, and I know your work in trauma outside of your day job is where you spend most of your time, I think it's fair to say that the coronavirus is introducing the world, the country, the community to a new level of trauma. And I think, you know, we said this offline, the situation around the coronavirus is changing so rapidly that news from 5 days ago or status updates from 5 days ago may as well be 5 years ago in terms of how fast we've moved away. As a medical doctor, as a person trained in the healthcare field, working in institutions, I would like you just to, from your perspective and a person who deals with trauma, kind of unpack a little bit for the listeners. Where are we now? Where are we today? And where do you see in the weeks to come we are headed as a community, as a society? And what kind of trauma do you think we're going to have to adapt ourselves to?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, if I'll tell you my quote-unquote punchline first, which is time is life. And the everything we're seeing play out with the virus is just like what I see day to day when it comes to bullets. It looks the same to me. Here's my take. First of all, this is a public problem because the virus, unlike a bullet, actually is everywhere. And it is spreading very fast, as every public health expert said it would. That's not how we're used to interacting with diseases and problems. We think, okay, maybe somebody was sick. You were somewhere with them. You ate something bad. You touched their hands. You get sick. You feel symptoms. You go to the doctor. You get some medicine. You're done. We're kind of used to things making sense slowly in our day-to-day lives. Oh, something happened. I got sick. I did something about it. Then I was done. And that's because a lot of what makes us sick on a day-to-day basis is something we can see or understand, like somebody has a bad strep throat infection and then all the kids at daycare get it, or like trauma, somebody gets shot, you understand bleeding. These are how our day-to-day health concerns go. What's so different about this novel coronavirus is its ability to spread. And I do think if you understand that, you can understand everything you're seeing. So what is coronavirus? Well, there are other coronaviruses. This is the a new strain of coronavirus. So when we say novel, we're saying until December 2019, this virus was not this strain. This cousin, if you will, was not seen on the planet. What a virus is really strange because it's not like a bacteria. It's not like other kinds of diseases because a virus is a particle that can spread from person to person, and it's not actually alive per se. It doesn't have the ability to take in nutrients and reproduce itself on its own. The way a virus works is it gets through your ports of entry. What are the ports of entry in your body? Your mouth, your nose, your eyes. This is what lets stuff in. And then it goes and finds the cell that it wants to infect. It attaches to the cell and literally injects copies of itself, its DNA, its RNA. It's basically, that's the roadmap for what the virus is, into the cell, and then lets your cell do all the hard work to reproduce it. It uses your energy and your machinery to make copies of itself, just like you're a little Xerox, and it's just copy, 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 copy. It does that. This particular strain of the virus does that really well in your lungs, and it attacks your lung cells that are responsible for making mucus and for sweeping your airways clean. So over time, your lungs build up with junk, basically, and the next thing you know, you have pneumonia. So the thing about it is, how do you stop the virus from spreading from person to person? Because unlike a bacterial infection, you can take an antibiotic and kill it. It's very hard to kill something that's not actually alive. Yeah. And this thing is good at being alive even outside of your body. So we know from different people have heard different things. I just want to put out there that first there was a study done in California at UCLA looking at how long the virus could last outside the body in a laboratory setting. So this was like not real life. It was like a fake, like, let's just look at it in a lab. And it found that it can last on a droplet, which is like a droplet of spit or something after you sneeze or cough, for 3 hours. So if you're in a situation where you get in contact with somebody or space where someone's been hacking, sneezing, coughing like a plane, right, for a long time, you're going to, even if the person's not even in the room anymore, you could potentially get it. Now, that really requires a very specific set of circumstances where there's a lot of it getting like spewed out. But the bigger issue is how long it can last on a surface. And that study showed it could last for 24 hours on cardboard and 72 hours on anything hard like glass, metal, or plastic. So what I'm understanding and talking to my colleagues is that the bigger issue for coronavirus, for the general public, not necessarily inside a hospital, but for the general public, is that it can be on a surface where somebody was 2 days ago. And you touch that surface, and then you touch your face, it goes in your eyes, your nose, your mouth, and the next thing you know, you infected yourself and you don't even make a connection. So understanding those things is essential to understanding why the restrictions have been getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And with all due respect, again, I'm not an infection disease expert, but I will say it would have been better if we went to the extreme level of lockdown that we're seeing happen now earlier. Because the idea is if everyone is at home, you're not in these public spaces to touch surfaces, to have droplets, to have interaction. And so the virus just has nowhere to go and it burns out. See, that's why the 7 to 14 day lockdown that you're seeing in Illinois is happening that way. The idea is if people have the virus and they've been in public spaces, if we're just not in those spaces together for many, many, many days, and people who have the virus all get identified, in the meantime, we're not unknowingly transmitting the virus. Does that make sense how I'm breaking it down so far?
You have done what I believe is a service to our listeners because you have opened up an explanation that is easy for people to get their minds around on a subject and a matter that is very, very medically complicated. Viruses in and of themselves are very, very difficult pathological disease ideas to digest, because they are not like you mentioned, they're not like bacterial infections.
Exactly.
And people often don't know exactly what the remedy is for a virus, because a bacterial infection, my doctor will give me an antibiotic. For a headache, I take the pill. For a backache, I take this. And even in the traumatic case of a gunshot wound, I get the bullet out and you stitch me up. Virus has its own shelf life that's very, very different. So thank you for explaining that. The one thing that I want people to hear from you to talk about that people may not understand is the idea that an individual could be a carrier or a host, if you will, for this for this virus and be asymptomatic. That seems to be very confusing to some people.
It is really hard to understand, because you're like, well, either I have it or I don't. But again, remember, this is a particle that's going to attach to your cell and reproduce itself. But if it's not enough of it and it doesn't get to a critical level of reproduction, maybe you're young and healthy and your immune system fights it and doesn't let it make all those copies or kills it with an antibody as soon as, you know, it's been reproduced. Or let's say you're like a little kid. Little kids are still able to get the virus, although it's less frequent that they're getting it. Basically, younger, healthier people are going to be able to have the virus in their body and not necessarily have it multiplying and attacking their lung cells to the point where they get a fever and cough. We know that silent transmission of the virus through young, healthy people was one of the main modes of transmission during the SARS epidemic that happened in Asia the years prior. So basically, just because you have it doesn't mean you know it. For instance, there are other viruses that we know about that people can have. Like, you can have the virus that causes a cold sore, right?
Yes.
But you don't always have a cold sore on your mouth because the virus isn't active. It's not quite like that, but the idea is because it's a different kind of bug, it acts a different kind of way. And in fact, we know that it might take as long as 14 to even 21 days after the point of exposure for you to develop symptoms of the virus.
Wow.
And you might not develop symptoms ever. So that's what makes it really, really hard to know if you're spreading it or not.
And isn't that also why we have to really take seriously the instructions for social distancing, staying away from people who may have been exposed, and not acting like because we don't see someone coughing or sniffing that everything is okay? I think we have been lulled into a false sense of, if we don't see a person that looks sick, we assume that they're not.
Yeah, so that's an interesting concept. So why is social distancing or physical distancing the answer? Because what did I just say? The way you're going to get it is from someone spewing a droplet on you if they sneeze without their mouth covered or cough without their mouth covered, or you touching them. So shaking hands is literally the worst possible thing, because then you're taking everywhere that person's been for essentially the last 3 days, right? And assuming they didn't wash their hands. Hopefully they washed their hands. But you're taking everywhere they've been, let's say, in the last few hours, if they haven't washed their hands, and then you're taking everywhere you've been in the last few hours, and you're like, let's flip a coin and see if somebody's touched one of the spaces where we've been with the virus. So that's how it can spread. Let me tell you a story. You know about patient 31?
Yes, ma'am.
The in Korea, in South Korea? The patient 31 in South Korea was a patient that changed single-handedly the epidemic in South Korea. They were doing a good job of controlling the virus using social distancing. This person was in a car accident, went to a hospital. While she was at the hospital, she left the hospital, go to church, came back to the hospital, and then did a checkup appointment, and then had one more some kind of visit. 9,000 people went to the church that she went to.
Wow.
And her single case became responsible at the time for over 80% of the subsequent cases that happened in South Korea.
I want to take a break on that point. This is a critical point. I want to pick this up after the break because I want people to hear this clearly, that what one person can do in transmission is effective of thousands of people. We'll be back after our first break of Insider Talk. We're talking to Dr. Punch. We're talking about the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, and giving you some perspective that I hope you all will take seriously. We'll be back after a moment with more Insider Talk. Welcome back to Insider Talk. Folks, today I'm talking about what I believe is probably one of the most important topics I've ever talked about in my 11 years of doing this show. The guest who has been kind enough to come on today is Dr. Punch. She's in her personal capacity. She has credentials. She is a trauma surgeon. She's connected to one of our great institutions for teaching. But for today's purposes, she's talking about her perspective on the novel coronavirus and the trauma that inexorably will affect us all and is affecting us all. You know, Dr. Punch, before the break, you began to talk about patient 31 in Korea. And this story, I think, must be told and it must be illuminated so that people get it. Far too often, we don't understand the impact of one individual on many of us. And would you please just sort of recap what happened with that one individual who had the accident, left the hospital, went to her church?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a patient who, a person who had the virus, didn't know, developed, was in an accident, ended up in basically three major public spaces, a hospital, a church, and a clinic appointment. At some point in time, began having fever, but had the disease long before then, and basically became responsible for over 80% of all the cases that happened in South Korea. You know, people, if you think about what COVID is, COVID is coronavirus disease 2019. That's what COVID-19 is. And so the disease happens in people in different ways depending on their body and their health. So coronavirus is the virus, but the disease it causes is called COVID-19. And so people who are older, over the age of 50, people who have medical problems, specifically people who have lungs that don't function at typical capacity at baseline, so people who have really bad asthma, people with COPD or emphysema, people who are smokers, that group of people are exceptionally at high risk for getting a more severe version of COVID-19 than young, healthy kids who might not even know they have it at all. So that's kind of another way to think about the disease. You know, and that gets me to another point I really want to emphasize in all of this, which is the number one thing you can do to prevent transmitting it and to prevent infecting yourself is to wash your hands.
I don't think that you could overstate that point.
And also to think about where you're putting your hands. That's the whole point of social distancing. I'm getting to a point where my advice to my friends is if you're going to a grocery store, you have to have a personal hygiene practice where you're going to either, even wearing gloves isn't enough. You have got to bring yourself to consciousness about if you're going to be in a public space and touch something, you cannot touch your face until you have decontaminated your hands. As a surgeon, I very much know how to move in and out of spaces where I have to protect the sterility, right? If I walk into an operating room, I have to have a hat on. If I walk into the actual room, I have to put a mask on. And if I go up to the field, I have to have gloves and a gown on. That's how I think we need to think about it. If you're just in your house, and you haven't been in contact with anything, it's like you're outside of the operating room. You don't need to have hat, mask, gloves. Just washing your hands normally is good. As soon as you go into public, suddenly, boom, you need some level of protection, and that includes keeping your hands clean. If you're going to go into a space where there's definitely a chance for transmission, that's why, for instance, healthcare professionals need hats, masks, gloves. You don't necessarily need those things just for general everyday life, but the best thing is to simplify life if you can and avoid public spaces and interacting with folks who have been in public spaces. I think that's Ron, if I could just talk about that for a second.
Please.
That's the hardest thing. So first of all, I'm a doctor. I have a kid and I have a mom, right? So my mom, grandma, helps me with my kid. And I'm in a space where I'm potentially coming in contact with people who could have the virus, right?
Yes, ma'am.
I have to assume that I'm getting exposed until we get better testing. I have decided I cannot see my mother for the next several months. Like, we have made a plan. We're doing FaceTime calls, and that's fine. But the problem is she was helping me with my kid. So I've had to radically change my life so that I don't let him be a silent vector in between her and I. Now, these are the kinds of steps where you've got to not just think about you, you've got to think about the people around you. And let me tell you, that is just like trauma. When someone gets shot, 100 people feel it. I say this all the time. Well, the virus is literally bringing trauma to life because we are living each other's collective experience. What you do impacts my life no matter what when it comes to the virus. It's almost like trauma coming to life.
And I think that what you've just described with your own narrative, your own life, of how you have to distance yourself from your own mother and also be conscious of your son as a carrier, as a potential conduit to transmitting to her, is going to be tough for people. But I'm really glad you personalized this so that it was not some sort of distant story. What I think we need to hear more of is those personal stories from healthcare experts who are saying, I am in the know and this is what I am doing. Because I still think, even though we're now in the last probably week or so understanding the gravity, there's still too many people that are othering themselves from this virus in this way. That's happening to those people over there, or that's happening in that country or that part of the country, but it's not happening to me and to my family. And I think, unfortunately, that kind of self-imposed ignorance, if you will, about how you could be affecting others is probably going to cause us more harm than good. You raised a point that I want to talk about, and we talked about this before. Please stress again that there is a scenario where someone could not feel like they have the coronavirus, but yet they could be a carrier and a transmitter to someone that they do love, and the consequences thereafter could be, and I want to not hype this, but it could be death to someone you love, even if you didn't feel sick. Is that a fair assessment of what could happen if we're not extremely careful?
That is exactly the truth. You could literally be the reason why somebody in your family dies, especially someone older, definitely over the age of 70, somebody who has diabetes, somebody who has lung problems. That person, if you are in public spaces, you need to isolate that person. The data is showing that the death rate is, you know, high. I've seen numbers around 15% for people with diabetes if they get this virus. And so, you know, I think, Ronnie, we believe that we are not connected, but there are lots of traditions and faiths that talk all the time about the sort of connection across the universe that we all really have to one another. This virus is making it real. Yes. We live in a global community. If something happens in South Korea, we feel it in St. Louis. And if something happens in Seattle, Washington, it ends up in New York City. This is our interconnectedness. And it's not a problem. I mean, I think people view it as a fuel for being horribly xenophobic and racist. And I have spoken out explicitly that this is not a China problem, and we should not use derogatory language to describe this. This is not anyone's fault. This is the reality of living in a global society and being in part of an evolving human race.
You know,
we have to take responsibility for each other and recognize our interconnectedness.
I'm so glad that you said the last point. This is, you know, I've had people say to me, I want to just assume that it is what I call benign ignorance, meaning that they weren't trying to be, but, oh, this is a disease that affects, and then they project it on a different group of people. I'm not a physician.
Yep.
I'm not a doctor by any stretch. But one of the things I've tried to say to people in those small bilateral, sometimes trilateral conversations is, let me explain to you something. A virus does not care about your ethnicity, your race, your gender, your socioeconomic status. A virus is looking for a host, and then if it gets to the right person, it will take the life of that person. So please, let's move away from any kind of racial, ethnic classifications, because you and the entire medical community have been consistent. This is a new virus. This virus, in the spirit of any other virus, is looking for a host to attack. Doesn't care about how rich or poor. You know, we just had a situation, a very tragic situation, where the family in New Jersey that attended the wedding, and a number of them have died. I can't think of a more tragic but realistic situation where you have an event that is centered around the epitome of love in Western society, a wedding, that has produced death of those whom the bride and groom wanted to share their most sacred moment with. And it gets to the point of the unintended host transferring this, regardless of what you think or what you feel. And so I really appreciate you illuminating for us that this is not a virus that will have the same impact on every carrier, and on a young person, maybe not as as deadly. And we don't know. Time will tell. Because initially, Dr. Punch, we were talking about, and I remember people saying, even a week and a half ago, well, this was a disease that most certainly would kill senior citizens with multiple underlying conditions, but 80% of the healthy people would just, it'd be like the flu. That's proving to not be the case. How much?
Yeah, I mean, there are people as young as in their 20s dying from it. There was somebody age 18, I believe, that died of it. If you have any kind of medical problems, in particular that affect your lungs, it really doesn't matter your age. And the thing about it is, it's not something you want to risk, right? Because once again, even if you don't get symptoms so bad that you end up dying, you might get sick enough that you end up in the hospital. And this is the idea of flatten the curve that I want to talk about for 2 seconds. When the virus is here and spreading, it's like a zombie apocalypse, right? They're like everywhere, right? And like the idea is stay in the house so the zombies don't get you, and then they'll go away. But if we go out, the zombies get us, the virus gets us, and then somebody's sick, and then somebody's sick. It multiplies in us the same way it multiplies in ourselves. And suddenly, 2 to 2 is 4, 4 to 4 is 16, 16. You multiply as you multiply, and you create a very steep curve in the numbers of people who get sick. But guess what? There is a threshold for how many hospital beds, medical professionals, health professionals, equipment, ventilators we have to take care of that rush of patients. If everybody gets sick all at once, they will overwhelm the healthcare system, and we won't be able to give people what they need to get through it. Even if, let's say, they had a severe case, but maybe were not going to die if they just got appropriate medical care. In other words, what I'm trying to say is this: young people can get it. Young people can get sick from it. Young people might need to go to the hospital with it. But if everybody gets sick all at once, there won't be enough beds in the hospital to take care of people. And people will die, not because they got so sick, but because they got so sick and there was no health care available to them. That is the situation in real time that has happened in Italy.
I don't think that there's a more salient point about why we have to respect the government mandates and rules about sheltering and separating than the point you just made. We have to take our final break. I know you have a zeal and a passion for trauma. As we think about virus implications, the separation that we must now adhere to, and really the sociological change, because I think we're in a new normal in how we approach living our lives in the wake of this virus, and we're still in the beginnings of it in this country. I want to really dive into, from your perspective, the traumatic impact, because I think people are very comfortable to understand the physical implications of a virus and the sickness and the death. But I think there's another serious layer to this that is to come, and I think it's in your wheelhouse to talk about it. It's the trauma, the mental trauma that people who may never be exposed to a coronavirus or COVID will actually experience a certain level of trauma-related stress. We'll pick this up after the break. This is Insider Talk. I don't have a more important topic or a better guest to talk to than the coronavirus. It is affecting our society like nothing in our lifetime. And we'll pick this up after the break. Thank you, Dr. Punch. Welcome back to Insider Talk. We are continuing our conversation and we're running out of time. So I want to get to some of the, I think, some things that will be important for you all to understand. I've got Dr. Punch on. She is here in her private capacity. She is credentialed at the most prestigious, one of the most prestigious hospital institutions in the country and one of the best academic institutions. But today she's talking from her personal perspective. She's sharing insights with me and with you all about coronavirus. If you couldn't listen to this show in its entirety, please go to the podcast and listen on your smart device at your convenience to the Dr. Punch edition of Insider Talk. You know, Dr. Punch, I met you because, in part, not because you're a phenomenal trauma surgeon, not because you're connected to a great institution, but I met you because you had a passion for dealing with trauma that was emanating, adjacent, and connected, and reverberating from violence. And so that drew us into a pretty close circumference. And now what I am beginning to think about and I'd like you to illuminate on is there is a level of trauma that has nothing to do with a gunshot or being a victim of an assault that I think is going to is developing around coronavirus. It's developing in the minds and the hearts of many, many people in this country and around the world. And I really would like to get your perspective on just exactly what you think the traumatic implications of coronavirus will be and are from a traumatic perspective on Americans.
So I define trauma in my work as energy transfer. So energy is going from one source into another source. So for instance, if you get shot, there was energy in the gun and the gunpowder and the bullet that transfers into your body and creates destruction. If you're in a car collision, then there was energy as you were driving down the highway, and then as you hit something, that energy and that force gets transmitted to your body. That creates tremendous physical disruption. But trauma can come from any energy source. So that can be emotional energy when someone's yelling at you. It can be financial energy when you lose a lot of money. It can be psychological when you're under an enormous amount of stress. Trauma doesn't care. It's actually not at all limited to physical forms. And there's probably a lot more trauma that happens in the world that's not physical. And what happens to you after you experience trauma? You literally have trauma. I mean, it your whole body and mind experience that energy transfer. And the question is, what do you do with it? What do you do with it beyond the physical once you have this experience? Well, your brain does the best that it can to deal with the fact that you've just been threatened, that something has happened that's transferred energy that was not intended for good. That's the other thing. Violence is generally trauma not intended for good. Sometimes trauma is unintended and accidental, but violence is like, no, I intended this. Either way, whether it's intended or not intended, your brain senses threat and goes into fight or flight mode. I mean, you are made to survive. The problem with fight or flight mode, or sometimes also can add in there freeze mode, is that you don't make the highest, best decisions that you could make. You don't act as your strongest, best self. You get physical feelings like nervousness and achiness and upset stomach and headache, and you have a hard time holding still. You don't want to move at all. It affects everything when you have trauma. Our community, unfortunately, does not always understand the concept of having trauma because we don't talk about it enough. Instead, we're like, you know, something happens to you, just deal with it, toughen up. But the truth is, when you experience trauma, your whole being is experiencing the event, and working through it is not easy. Now, and I think when it comes to the coronavirus and what is happening in our community, the entire world is being threatened. And the thing about it that I think is really, really, really hard is the unknown. The lack of control. Do I have the virus? Am I not? Am I spreading it? Am I not? Can I go to the store? Can I not? Can I go to work? Can I not? Who's going to watch my kids? Do I have a home to be in? Do I have running water and places to do hygiene? It's asking us to do a lot with very little information. As a trauma surgeon, I'm used to making decisions that are life and death with very little information. It's what I do. But in general, in life, we like to understand what's going on. And we certainly don't want to have to make decisions about work and life and kids and moving and doing things. And we don't even know really what's going on. This is where trauma really kicks in, because it steals our ability to make intelligent, calm, and informed decisions, and instead just has a snapback with an attitude, or freeze out of fear, or just want to run away. And these are the kinds of responses, I think, that are going to make coronavirus worse. We can't run away. We can't just snap back and be angry, and we can't freeze. We've got to act with the best information we have in a way that preserves our health. And that's why having me on this show, 100% I would do this, and I will keep doing it to try to help people understand. I know it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. I know it's really hard, but I also know that we can trust that washing our hands, keeping a distance, and being mindful of the places and people we're coming in contact with is not wrong, because this is real. And we can do better than just have a trauma response to it.
And Dr. Punch, that is extremely helpful. And I want to reiterate something I think that you're getting at. We are going through an incredibly challenging emotional, medical, societal time. And so there is going to be emotional trauma. But we are not, as a people, we're not completely helpless. We're not sitting on the sidelines without an ability to respond. There are things that we can do today to mitigate the spread of the virus, to mitigate the severity of the trauma, and to really protect ourselves and our loved ones and our neighbors and our communities. And
Absolutely. And
would you say that those active steps, those things will help to address to some degree, I don't know the degree, but some degree, or to mitigate the level of trauma that we will ultimately experience if we are not if we are guarded and careful versus if we are reckless and, equivocal?
Absolutely. I have taught many, many people in the St. Louis region how to, quote unquote, stop the bleed. That's what you do after someone's been hurt or shot and is bleeding, because when someone is bleeding, time is life. We have the ability right now to stop the virus. Listen, guys, the virus is here. It's here. And the best we can do is stop it from having an effect where it ends people's lives. And we can do that by paying attention and going through stepwise thoughts and practices, just like I teach in Stop the Bleed, so that we don't end up with more people dying than need to.
As people are listening, and I really do believe I have some great listeners, people have been listening to the show for a long time, people who care, they're going to want to carry this message forward, but they're also going to want more information. To the extent that you can, where can people find more information about the virus, what to do, credible information? You know, unfortunately, social media today and the internet is full of misinformation, disinformation, and just bad information. So if people wanted some credible sources, is it the CDC? Is it the State Health Department? Just kind of give us some trusted places to go for our Google searches to get updates that are not crap or misinformation, but actually credible and actionable and informative from your perspective.
Yeah, so here's the sources that I, as an individual, am checking every single day. Number one, the CDC website. Now, the CDC isn't perfect, and there are people who are criticizing it for being slow. But I haven't seen it give people information that was actively leading them into harm's way or that was overstating the impact of the virus. Number two, the World Health Organization. It's another organization that's helping think about the virus overall throughout the world. It kind of helps you see, because honestly, time speaking, we are 11 days behind Italy. So I'm watching what's happening in Italy so that I can interpret what might be happening here, because the curve in the United States, unfortunately, looks a lot more like the curve in Italy than it does in China. And so I'm using that information to inform myself. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post honestly have done some fairly decent reporting and put out some really great graphics. Now, how do you get access to that? That's kind of frustrating because depending if you have internet access, but usually the New York Times will, if you have even on a smartphone, you can go to New York Times and you can just put your email if you have an account and they'll let you look at it. People who can look at the World Health Organization, CDC, New York Times, Washington Post, those are folks that are going to already have access to the information and already be able to discern what it says. What I'm really worried about is that we need to make video-based, easy to understand, right here, right now, updated information for people. I think information is the biggest tool, right after hand washing, that we have. And I'm looking to places like more radio stations, more newspapers, to really responsibly report on this, because you're right, it's really, really tough. But those are the places that I'm looking to get my information. I also have information from my workplace that I'm using to try to inform my efforts. And so just know that I haven't told you anything today that's not consistent with highest level guidance that I've heard in multiple spaces. And I'm doing my best to urge everyone to stay home, wash your hands, and avoid public spaces.
Dr. Ponch, I really want to thank you this Sunday for sharing what I believe is life-saving, timely, critical, objective information. I know that you're extremely busy. I want to take a moment to thank you for not just the time you've given us today, but you are the front line. You and your thousands of healthcare workers who are every day dealing with the sick among us, the dying, the ailing, and the ailing. You guys are our front line. I mean, you are the ones that are in the hospitals dealing with patients, not just coronavirus, but all the numerous patients that you have to deal with. And I know that a lot of people say, well, you get paid, you're this and that. But your guys are putting, and you're at a point now with this virus where you're putting your lives at stake and you're putting the lives of your loved ones at stake. So just like we have this trend in our nation that's well-deserved and well-established of thanking soldiers for their service and the time that they've spent in many cases abroad, I think it's very important that we, the public, thank you guys, support you all in our healthcare field, hospital workers, nursing homes, hospice facilities where you're dealing with the sick and the ailing, and in some cases, as you've said a couple times, just naturally in this conversation, exposing yourselves, but not just yourselves, your loved ones to this virus. So I thank you for your academic and intellectual sharing, but really I thank you for the work that you do every day in our hospital systems and will continue to do, and we will certainly look forward to having you back on Insider Talk to talk more as we work through this life-changing pandemic that has no precedent. Someone asked me earlier today what I compared this to, and I said, I'm going to do my best, and I want you to visualize this with me, and I want to say this to the listeners as we wrap. If you could take Pearl Harbor, 9/11, and the Great Concession and put them all into one package, I think you get pretty good snapshot of what we're dealing with now. It is all of those things combined together, and then there are many aspects that we are yet to learn. It is that serious. This is not hype. This is reality. And I think if we are smart about this, and if we listen to the healthcare community, the political leaders who are trying to give us objective guidance, I think we can come out of this thing with our souls and our health somewhat intact, but there will be deaths, there will be pain, and there will be trauma. And that is why I wanted to talk to you today. Once again, thank you, Dr. Ponch, for your time. We will certainly have you back on this show, and I greatly appreciate the work you're doing and will continue to do.
Absolutely. And everybody out there, just be safe.
Thank you. Folks, have a blessed Sunday. Tune in next week for more Insider Talk. Listen to other shows on the station. We'll be talking about the coronavirus. Please go to the CDC. Go to whatever objective source is giving information and facts. Arm yourself with information. Execute. Follow the guidelines. Protect yourselves and your loved ones. Until next week, have a blessed Sunday.
Get more at 971talk.com.